the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fatty Show.
It is just ignorance, my dear fellow. These people are simple in their outlook.
I'm Sean.
I'm Trish.
I'm David.
And we're here for yet another fantastic, fabulous, wonderful, scary torture cinema. So applause, please.
Clap, 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 clap.
Okay, bad jokes aside, we're here to talk about one of David's favorite films, the 1958 thrill-tacular Fiend Without a Face. So this should be very exciting. Are you excited, David?
I'm very excited, Sean.
That's good, because you made us watch this.
I did.
I'm holding you personally responsible for this movie.
I will happily take that responsibility to my grave.
Yeah, you and Marshall Thompson, because he's also responsible. But we'll get into that in a minute. So before we dive into the movie itself, we always have to talk about what we're drinking. So I'm going to start with you, Trish. What are you drinking?
Well, I'm working later today, so I'm having Pure Hydro, and I'm also indulging in a, what is it called? Coffee Thins espresso flavor. I mean, chocolate wafer.
Sounds delicious. Excellent. David, what about you?
Well, breakfast wasn't that long ago, so I had orange juice.
That's right, because you're slightly at a different time zone.
A bit behind you.
Yeah, a little behind me. So you actually are justified in having breakfast. I'm on lunch, so. And I happen to be drinking whatever remains in my Sencha green tea glass and water. And there are a couple of reasons why we are not imbibing. One of them is I'm on a specialty diet, so I can't drink a lot of alcohol. And the other is we are recording at noon, which means drinking hard alcohol at noon on a Saturday, generally not socially acceptable, unless it's a football game. This is definitely not a football game. So that's why we're not drinking anything fun. Yeah, but here's the thing you could do is if you're listening to this right now, pause it, go to your fridge, get something out of the fridge that's alcoholic, and you could drink for us while you listen.
There you go.
But don't do it while you're driving your car, because I know some people listen to this episode while they're driving, and that would be very irresponsible.
Well, hopefully they don't have refrigerators in their cars.
Although that would be cool. You can just get whatever you want, cold drink right now.
Well, if you're riding in your limousine, there's probably a mini fridge.
Well, then it's fine, yes.
So, in any case, we need to dive into the movie itself, Fiend Without a Face, since, as I mentioned before, this is one of David's favorite movies of all time. He has been given the honor of explaining what this movie is about. So, David, what is Fiend Without a Face about?
Well, mysterious deaths are plaguing the Manitoban community of Winthrop, about which more I shall have more to say later. The superstitious locals of this community, about which I shall have more to say later, are convinced that it is the fault of the nuclear radiation coming from the gigantic American Air Force base. Marshall Thompson, as Major Cummings, thinks this is nonsense, and he swans about like he owns the place, trying to figure out what's going on. And in fact, the culprits are the titular fiends without a face. What are they? We won't raise the spoiler wall yet, but the poster for the movie has a fairly strong clue.
They're rats.
Rats have faces.
Well, they're faceless rats. My cat literally jumped down when he heard that. Faceless rats, he got excited. No, they're not rats, but we will be talking about what they actually are very soon. So thank you for that lovely, lovely thing, David. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So we need to get into this movie, our likes and our dislikes. Which means at this point, as David mentioned, spoiler wall, because we're kind of going to ruin what the Fiends Without a Face are and other lovely and delicious things. So our first like goes to you, Trish. What do you got?
Okay, I actually have two likes for this movie, but I will stay away from the first one because I think someone else is going to pick it. So for my second like, it was pretty consistent because it wasn't just one thing about the movie that was stupid. Sorry, David. Everything was stupid. The townsfolk are ignorant about radiation, and so is the colonel. The major is stupid about manners. The romance subplot is stupid. The creatures are stupid, I say. And the thing that happens at the end and its lack of consequences is treated stupidly. So at least the good thing is I don't feel like any one group is treated unfairly, not the townies, not the Air Force people, because everything was treated as being stupid. So that's my like.
So wait, let me get this straight. Your like is that the movie is stupid.
It's uniformly stupid.
That's what I like.
Uniformly stupid. That's like a step up from when I would do things like the tree union is well represented in this movie because there are a lot of trees. Which I have done with various items, including the dead body suppliers union, the grass union, the beautiful skies union. I have done many union things, but you have taken it a step past that, Trish, by just flat out giving in to the fact that you hate this movie and saying my like is that at least it's consistently not good.
There are movies that I have hated much more because of egregiously bad things that have been done or bad decisions. I'm actually serious. I was pleased that it wasn't just the townies who were being stupid. You know, it started out, oh, this movie is making fun of Hicks. But then, you know, it showed that some of their concerns were justified. And so, you know, it was even-handed. And I liked that.
All right. Well, fair enough, Trish. I appreciate your candor. All right, David. Well, we're going to dive into your first like. I have a feeling it's going to be a doozy.
Well, and so here's where the spoiler wall comes into play. My like is the fiends themselves. They are invisible for most of the movie. And then when they do appear, they don't have faces, but they're still kind of cute. They're lovingly stop-motion animated brains that move themselves along with their spinal columns like caterpillars. And they have little wiggly antennae, and they suck your brains out the back of your neck. They are among the more memorable B-movie monsters from the period. Their demises are spectacularly gory for the time. When they're shot, they explode in blood while making wet fart noises. And they in a film where they are meant to be materialized thought, and they are materialized thought appears as a brain. I mean, there's something so charmingly literal-minded about that, and takes the idea of monsters being symbolic to its logical conclusion. So I think they're absolutely delightful.
They're also super creepy.
Yeah, they're creepy and they're cute.
Creepute?
Yeah, and they're also pioneers, because that siege in the farmhouse predates The Birds by 5 years and Night of the Living Dead by 10.
And there's a lot of similarity in the way that scene is constructed, based on 10-year-old knowledge of Night of the Living Dead.
Well, barricading the windows, and they, I mean, it's obviously not the first siege of cinema, but definite echoes of movies to come. And just think how much fun there would have been if we'd had ambulatory brains in Night of the Living Dead or The Birds.
No.
Well, as far as things that were from this movie that were echoed later, this movie, to me, seemed a pretty clear echo of something that came before. Forbidden Planet came out in 1956. This came out in 1958. Forbidden Planet, of course, has thought or impulses of the id made to have physical force in the world. And it's like the makers of this movie decided, you know, that's really just too complex. People didn't understand that. Let's not have, you know, invisible force monsters. Let's just have invisible and later visible brains.
Yeah, it is a kind of sort of almost bald-faced version of that. In fairness, though, too, it was based on a short story that initially appeared in Weird Tales in 1930.
Right.
Okay. Very well.
I don't think one can get away from the fact that Forbidden Planet was, you know, kind of casts a pretty long shadow, right? So, and I can't imagine that, I can easily imagine the filmmakers going, "Hey, this worked really well in Forbidden Planet. Now let's do this."
Well, the other thing I thought was really interesting is while I watched this, I kept getting like flash forwards to Alien. Because they're just their brains feel so much like the headhuggers that they just feel like it, the facehuggers.
Oh, that's interesting. That had never occurred to me. But now that you point that out, I mean Alien have certainly deliberately looks back to 1950s monster movies the way Star Wars flashes back to 1930s serials. With the really and I mean its big model is It, the Terror from Beyond Space. Where spaceship lands on planet on rescue mission, accidentally picks up monster who starts killing off crew one by one. Right, there's the basis. But you've got we get our first man being impregnated by an alien in the 1950s, also with Night of the Blood Beast. So yeah, I mean, who knows, that image of the the brains from Fiend Without a Face has certainly been resonating through popular culture since then.
Yeah, it's one thing I wondered is whether or not there is an actual like through line that like maybe Geiger borrowed from it, or Ridley Scott thought about it, or someone along the line that image, like you could trace it back in any way to this, because it just seemed too familiar. I mean, just the way that the brains, like literally they jump on you, they wrap around you, and then they suck your brain and your spinal column out so that they can make a new version of themselves, which is not dissimilar from Alien, which is just kind of the reverse. They put something into you, which then kills you by bursting out of you and becoming, well, the xenomorph. But yeah, I don't know. There's just, yeah, it's a creepy image, and the little brains are just, they're ridiculous, but they're also kind of awesome.
Well, and I guess the way that they move in particular, I think we see that even more so in Aliens, right? Because the facehugger in Alien is essentially motionless, right? It jumps out, and then we don't really see it move much at all again for the rest of its screen time. But in Aliens, we get all the scuttling around of the facehuggers, and even an even closer mirror to the movement of the brains in here.
No, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Yeah, this is not very funny right now. We're just getting super serious talking about film illusions. So, well, okay, I guess it's my turn to do my single like about this movie, which is actually harder to come up with than I originally thought it would be, because I did not enjoy this movie very much. It was kind of ridiculous. But I kind of like Major Cummings, played by Marshall Thompson. I'd like his sort of very straight arrow, very practical kind of character, who also happens to be really ridiculously terrible at romance, but yet still gets the girl. I don't know how, I'm sure we'll come back to that later. But I liked his character because he's not presented the way I'm so used to a lot of military characters being presented, which is, you know, they're always like, maybe they're not evil, but they're always like on the wrong side of things. Whereas in this case, like, his character is just trying to get down to the what's going on. Like, he really wants to figure this out, and he's getting frustrated by all of the people trying to stop him from basically uncovering the truth and accepting the reality of the truth, which is that, on some level, the work he's doing with this atomic radar system, I don't know if that makes any sense. Someone who's in physics could probably explain that. Is actually involved with the thing that's actually killing everybody. So it's like mad scientist on one side and not mad scientist on the other. It's like two different science sides converging to create monstrosity. And him being in the middle, it's just really nice to see him. Also, I kind of like Marshall Thompson. He's hard not to like.
There is a kind of bumblingly affable quality to some of the time in the film. Though his portrayal of the military officer trying to figure out what's going on, I mean, that makes him fairly standard issue for films of that period. Most of the, especially in the B movies, if you had a military figure, they were likely going to be the protagonist.
Well, see, I did not know that, David.
like following on from the like you have, I mean, you sort of have I guess almost a kind of a split that appears in sort of two contrasting films in 1951 with The Day the Earth Stood Still, where you don't trust the military, at least well, to a degree you don't, versus The Thing, where you absolutely do. And Fiend Without a Face kind of follows along with, you know, The Thing and It Came from Beneath the Sea and so on, where, you know, the military is ultimately going to take care of whatever the problem is, even though quite often their activities are in some way connected with why there's a giant praying mantis or whatever or what it is in the first place.
A giant praying mantis. That's a wonderful image.
But they're not actively malicious.
No.
Even if I feel that the general was reckless, there was a point where the test was going on and the general was saying, more power, we need more power to make this work. And he was being told by the people at the plant and the experts that if we do more power, this thing could run out of control. And what that means is that you could have a meltdown of the nuclear plant, and that would be
right.
Very, 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 very bad. But he just said, no, more power, and everyone complied with his order, which is possibly believable. Certainly in a 1 hour and 15 minute B-movie, you're probably not going to have a heroic engineer at the plant refusing to obey a criminal order.
No, the guy who follows the orders like, eh, whatever. And someone else goes, but that's dangerous. And he's like, well, whatever.
Orders are orders.
And he just does it, and then he goes back to like his magazine or whatever he's doing.
Or in this film, this the sandwich, right?
Yeah, the sandwich. Yeah, yeah.
I love the sandwich guy.
There's like this. I don't know if this is gonna be a dislike for everybody, but one of the things I found frustrating about this movie is, so I'm not a nuclear physicist. I know nothing about nuclear anything, but I'm pretty sure the filmmakers who made this also didn't know anything about them, because they're just like things that are like nobody who runs a nuclear plant would be like, yeah, let's do the thing that'll make it even increasingly more likely to blow up. Like, I just don't buy that. Also, I don't know exactly what this rods thing is, but they keep having to pull rods out. And I didn't know that was a thing. You just, oh yeah, just pull rods out. It'll make it go faster.
That is actually a thing. The rods act as sort of dampeners to the reaction. And so the more rods you have in, the slower things are going on, the cooler the pile is. And if you pull out all the rods, you'll have a meltdown.
Wait, so let me get this straight, Trish. You're saying that, in fact, this movie knows more about nuclear physics than I do.
Except it ignores it totally at the end.
Okay. Well, at least I get that saving grace. Because just, like, all kinds of stuff, like, well, I'm sure we'll come back to some of that, because I imagine it's going to be in David's dislike certain perspectives on atomic energy that come up in this movie. But I mean, in general, like, all the science in this is kind of wacky. It's not unusual, I think, from the 50s movies I've seen that have mad scientists. But, like, I mean, the notion that he's just going to use his brain and, like, you just attach it to a battery and then you'll get telekinesis. Like, that's not how it works. And I'm pretty sure by 1958, we knew by then that's not how you get telekinesis. You can't just plug someone into a battery and they just suddenly can move pages with their mind. That just, no. Like, the second he did that, I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. If that were the case, all those kids in the 50s who accidentally stuck their finger into the plug would have had telekinesis, and we would have known about it, and we would have weaponized it against the goddamn Soviets, and we would have won, like, in a week, because we would have just telekinesis'd everyone to death.
Thank goodness we've become so much more sophisticated now and flock in our millions to see movies about robots that turn into cars.
That makes more sense to me than plugging your brain into a battery.
I don't think we actually did know that much about telekinesis in the 1950s.
I don't think we know a lot much more about telekinesis today.
I think we knew that much, though. Like,
no, in the 50s, you had the CIA doing their men who stare at goats experiments and stuff
like that.
You know, you had all kinds of wacky science stuff going on. I'm perfectly willing to believe that this scientist was conducting weird experiments.
Okay, you don't think that Edison and Tesla, Like, both sat down one day, accidentally electrocuted themselves, and realized, yeah, that doesn't do anything except hurt.
Well, Tesla's secrets died with him. Edison certainly would have patented telekinesis through battery if he had ever stumbled across it.
I guess it's the difference between alternating current and all that, you know, which one gives you telekinesis?
Well, we have a long, long and honorable history of electricity performing all sorts of wonders in the movies.
True.
From the dawn of movies onwards, right? I mean, perhaps one of the most memorable ones in the previous decade was Man-Made Monster, where Lon Chaney Jr. becomes immortal and deadly through being dosed with increasingly high doses of electricity. The Frankenstein monster springs to mind.
No. I'm not going to give you that one, David. And here's why. I'm not giving you that one because basically Frankenstein invented the defibrillator. The heart starter gets
defibrillator.
Me. Yeah, you go. Yeah. It invented that. It just did it with nature because you could use electricity to start a heart. Now, I'm not saying the rest of the science holds up because it doesn't. But at least that much. I could almost buy a little bit that a little electricity could actually start a heart.
I find your lack of suspension of disbelief disturbing, young man.
I mean, yeah, but okay. But at the same time, like, we're finding all kinds of weird ways to bring things back from the dead. So, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll do a Frankenstein monster and that'll be a whole other thing. The point is, I'm just saying that in this case, he should have known better that electricity doesn't cause telekinesis and allow you to materialize brain spinal creatures out of nothing.
Only it did, so he was right.
No, he's not right. This is propaganda, David. It's propaganda, it's lies.
Sean, I've forgotten what your like was.
Oh, it's Marshall Thompson as
Major Cummings. Yep.
Because I just found him likable. I mean, setting aside, like, this is the second movie in a row where I've had to watch, like, grown-ass white men really badly try to romance women and yet still get the girl. Like, the other one I watched was the Batman the Movie, 1966. And so I've got a drinking game. I'm just going to get this out and then we'll move to dislikes. So if you ever watch the 1966 Batman movie and you want to play a drinking game, here's what you do. You get a bunch of shots, and every time Batman either looks like he's about to climax, says the word climax, or does something that metaphorically represents climax, you have to take a shot. And what I found is the first half of that movie, you would be completely sober, but the last half of that, you will be so trashed you won't even remember your own name, because the last half of that movie is basically just about ejaculation. And I've now ruined that movie for everyone.
Well, given some of the comments I've heard Adam West make about the double entendre working into the series, that could very well have been intentional.
Oh, God. It's so uncomfortable watching, like, Adam West trying... Okay. Sorry, I'd rather watch Major Thompson get his Mac on than watch Adam West do it. No offense, because I know he recently passed and everything, but sorry, dude. Like, maybe we should move on.
Let me break the rules and jump in with a real quick second like, since nobody took it, which is that the movie was short. It was only an hour and 15 minutes or something, and it was pretty efficient. The plot just kept moving along. And so even though I was arguing with things that happened, things kept happening, and I wasn't actually terribly bored watching it.
And let me jump in on your rule break with a minor one of my own and a kind of a secondary dislike before we even get to them. Because whereas I agree with you completely, and... really, there's actually very little I dislike about this film, but one that I do, for all that it is, it moves along and it's fairly short. There's this weird bit of padding, right? That whole scene when Marshall Thompson gets himself locked into the vault, what does that have to do with anything? It just feels like it's there to reach that 75 minutes.
You know, that scene really threw me for a loop, because it seemed like the whole point of that was going to reveal something, but the only thing it reveals isn't in the tomb itself. It's because he gets locked in there by the professor.
Yeah.
Right.
And we learned that air runs out in a big vault pretty quickly, apparently.
No, that's not how it works. They also don't understand how oxygen works at all. Or nitrogen, for that matter, since we mostly breathe nitrogen and oxygen. But, you know, the science or whatever.
But then to swing this back to you're like, Sean, we do, you know, Marshall Thompson is kind of charmingly helpless in that whole routine, just, you know, feebly banging against the vault with his candlestick and needing to be rescued.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they find him and he's like slumped against. Yeah, you're right. He just slumped there and they rescue him. We don't exactly know why he can't breathe, but I guess he can't. It should stink in there at least. Like, can you die from stink?
Well, if the stink is, you know, poison in the atmosphere, sure. I guess it is nice. We sort of get a damsel moment for the Major that way. There's a little bit of gender equity in that he's the one that has to be saved, sort of.
Yeah, certainly Kim Parker gets her damsel moments too, but I guess he has a nicely sustained damsel moment there. He has a whole scene of being passive and helpless.
And Barbara actually puts on pants to go out on her search in the woods. So I guess that's a sort of way to emphasize that she's taking the hero role in finding him and saving him.
There you go.
Yeah. Is she going to come up later or could we talk about her now?
Sure. Let's talk about her.
Well, okay. So because normally Julia would be the one to do this, but I don't want to use it for my dislike because I have another one. But so I really liked the character of Barbara. You know, she's this kind of a little spunky, but not too much. She's just sort of like a pretty much a side character. But the way she's initially presented is very competent, very much stands up for herself. You know, seemed like the kind of person who would actually be the one doing the science, right? And that's originally what I thought was coming up, was that she was working with the professor not as his secretary, but as like his scientific assistant, like actually doing science. And then it was revealed, like, she's a secretary, and she basically, and not even that, she's a secretary who's hired because other people think that the professor is feeble because he's old, not because he's been electrocuting himself for reasons. But, like, I found that really frustrating because here was this character who I thought was going to be, you know, like, she's working on a farm or something, or she's lived a farm life, she lives in this rural community, she's really strong. Has her own sort of determination, right? She tells the Major off a couple of times, and then it just sort of undercuts her in this as soon as it's revealed that she's a secretary. And not that there's anything wrong with being a secretary. I'm not saying that. I'm saying just the way she's presented takes that away from her, I felt.
To be fair, you're probably not going to get a lot of female scientists living in a such an isolated area as that seemed to be, and she was certainly using her brain and helping collate the stuff and everything. She wasn't just answering phone calls for the professor. She was helping him organize his research. And also, she was stubborn at first when interacting with the military, but she did recognize the facts and change her opinion about the testing and stuff, because although at first she blamed the poor milk production on the plains, she recognized that the cows got used to it, and she was telling the other townsfolk that, look, this isn't so bad, the cows got used to it, it's, you know, we shouldn't be so upset about the Air Force base.
That's fair.
So I think she did demonstrate intelligence in a lot of parts of the movie. I wasn't at all unhappy with Barbara's character, except for her falling in love with the Major for no reason.
Yeah, no reason, because he... Yeah, okay, we just all... Well, no, I'll come back. I'll come back to it. Don't worry. David, you wanted to jump in, please.
Well, I mean, I would agree that she's certainly, if you compare her to some of her other sort of contemporaries, like Joan Weldon's character in Them and Faith Domergue's in It Came From Beneath the Sea, that she, like the strength that they give her, they also undermine a lot more. And I think Actually, Faith Domergue's character in It Came From Beneath the Sea creates an interesting contrast with what you were saying, Trish, about the, winding up falling in love with the guy, though there's no reason for her to. In that film, where we see her character, you know, consistently going up against the sexism of Kenneth Toby, and along the way, she's the one who figures out there's a giant octopus and also designs the torpedo that ultimately kills the beast. But at the end of the film, when he asks her to marry him, she says no, he can come along with her on her book tour if he likes. Which, you know, for the mid-50s is quite striking. And so we, you know, there is that gap. We certainly don't get anything like that with Barbara in here. But she certainly is we. But yeah, I would agree. She does kind of stand up to the military, and she's not intimidated by anyone except Leaping Killer Brains.
Right.
Which, you know, fair enough. Yeah, I would be terrified and intimidated by that too. Not least of all because, my God, that's creepy. If like a brain with a spinal cord was following you with little antennae on the top.
And wanting to eat your brain?
Well, especially once I knew that part, because that's like one of my horrors. Like, that's the only reason zombies terrify me, is they bite into your head to get your brain. And I'm like, no. Zombies are scary. And they should just, no. Don't make them. Whoever, there's some crazy person on this planet who wants to make zombies, don't. It'll ruin everything.
PSA.
PSA, yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we should dive into our dislikes then. And that means we got to go back to you, Trish. What is your first and only dislike?
Okay. It's not that I have a hard time suspending disbelief for this movie. It's that disbelief is trying to hang me and strangle me with my own spinal cord.
Jeez, that's visceral.
The creatures are pure thought, so they're invisible, which is okay, but they should be intangible also, but instead they're scuffing through hay and puddles, and there's that pulsing noise that that people can hear, sort of like a drum beater. Maybe it's supposed to be like a heartbeat, but these things don't have hearts, so I don't really get that. Then when they get enough power to be visible, they move around like inchworms and spring through the air, and then and only then can you shoot them. And why were they, you know, the invisibility but tangible enough to scuff through dirt and puddles and things, but not tangible enough to fight? Okay, that was a problem.
Trish, you rattle off all those details like they're bad things.
They are, David. They are.
All right. Well, then I will pass on to my other major problem with the atomic plant. I already mentioned the colonel who apparently doesn't understand or care how the plant he's managing works. But at the end, after the rods have been destroyed so they can't slow down the reaction, much less turn it off, the major uses a matchbook fuse to short out the control panel, and that causes the entire plant to explode, which is not credible in itself. But if the plant really did explode like that, you would have radioactive waste all around the landscape. The entire place would be destroyed for miles and miles and miles around. You know, like Chernobyl or something. And I was really disappointed by that because I had been thinking that the brains would destroy themselves by melting down the plant because they kept increasing the power to make more brains and make themselves more powerful. So I thought they were going to cause the explosion. But no, you have this stupid short out the plant and make it explode with a matchbook fuse, which does not happen. And then, you know, once you have your radioactive hole in this area, good luck with your romance, Major and Barbara. And I hope since this is being filmed in Canada, you can get Canadian healthcare because of your three-headed kids to take care of them.
Well, yeah, this will just end up being, this is how The Hills Have Eyes started. The end of this movie is the beginning of The Hills Have Eyes.
Oh, there is a double bill.
So, yes. In summary, I can't put up with the logic problems in this movie.
It's really hard because I feel like now we know more stuff, like even in just basic K-12 education. I mean, this is the United States, so compared to David, David's K-12 education was like our PhD program, but, you know.
Hardly.
Well, I mean, these days I think we barely get through the ABCs by 12th grade, so... but, you know, like, you feel like you learned a lot. And so when you go back and you watch these old movies that are trying to be science-y, like, there's too much, like, where they try to make it seem like, oh, yeah, no, like, this is totally legit, when they should just do, like, hand-wavy them all over the place. Just like, yeah, no, it doesn't matter how it actually works. Just leave it. We don't need to explain it. Just let it go. Because this one tries to explain so many things, and when it does, it gets increasingly more absurd. You know, when the, like, literally, I've got the movie in the background, and the professor's explaining his whole thing about how he electrocuted his brain, and then eventually gained telekinesis, and then invented, out of pure thought, these monster creatures without faces, which miraculously don't kill him for some reason.
This is the science of cybernetics, whatever that is.
It's not real, David. And we've been over this. You can't electrocute your brain to be able to materialize thought as brains with spinal cords. It's just not, it's not how it works.
Well, but maybe cybernetics has something to say about that.
Or maybe the professor should have learned the first time he shocked his brain and nothing happened. Don't do it anymore. And then we wouldn't have these things. I don't know. Maybe if people did actual legit science in these movies, things would be better, what I'm saying.
Fortunately, we've moved on to actual legit science in all science fiction movies since.
But see, here's the thing. So you brought up, I know we're just back on this, but like, David, you brought up Transformers. But like, Transformers doesn't try to explain it. It's just like, yeah, they're giant robots that turn into cars and planes and stuff. Just accept it and we'll move on. There's no, like, we're going to spend 50 minutes explaining the biology of cybernetic people organisms that turn into vehicles for some reason. There's no explanation for that. We don't need to have a talk about it. You just got to accept it. If they had done that, if Transformers had spent, like, 15 minutes, which in a Michael Bay movie would not surprise me, explaining the biology of Transformers, that would make the first Transformers movie even worse than it actually is.
I just want to note, though, for the record, that Sean has just defended Transformers movies.
I think that's very important to note.
They're terrible, and they get increasingly worse with each one. Why are they still being made? Stop it.
Because they make $1 billion, yes.
They're still making pots of money. They'll keep making them until that stops happening.
Basically until China stops watching them. Because I think that's part of, like, I guess the domestic box office for the new one, not so great in the U.S., but in China, they're eating the crap out of it. So I guess they like it, so I guess we should move on. I totally stole your thunder, Trish, I'm sorry.
I was pretty much done with my dislike.
We're on the same page, though. So, oh no, now he's got the weird coil thing. He's going to hook his brain up to a giant, whatever. Okay, just move on. David, would you tell us your, I mean, I know it's going to be hard for you finding a dislike, but...
Well, my dislike in some ways is actually kind of alike. I mean, my dislike is in fact, one of the primary reasons why I teach this film. When I'm showing a science fiction course, film course, when I get to need to show a 50s B movie, there's really no choice but to show this one when you're teaching it in Manitoba, because here we have a movie that takes place in a place called Winthrop, Manitoba. Now, this vision of Manitoba, and no, there is no such place as Winthrop, is, you know, if you're from here and you see this movie, the vision is as ludicrous as if, let's say, a film announced that it was taking place in New York City, and what it showed you, what it would claim to be the skyline of New York City, was the Eiffel Tower, the Taj Mahal, and an erupting volcano. Because this colossal American Air Force base, well, in the background, we have these majestic snow-capped mountain peaks, which we don't have any of those in Manitoba. We are a prairie province. Our highest mountain is like a couple of thousand feet. And so, in other words, it's technically a hill to other people. It's an absolutely grotesque vision of Manitoba. And it transparently shot in England. You might have noticed that nobody in this movie sounds like me. There are all these stone farmhouses. And all this babble about the superstitious natives, and we're 1,000 miles from this nearest city of any size. So I guess we've also eliminated Minneapolis while we're at it, along with Winnipeg. So it's absolutely grotesque. But of course, I find it hilarious and charming, too. But this if I might have a moment of background here, because the period in which this film emerges is kind of interesting. Like, I sort of wonder, like, why is this supposedly taking place in Manitoba? What the hell? what possible reason could there be? And partly, I think it's because for I theorize that for a lot of American and British audiences, and this is an Anglo-American co-production, Canada is kind of this tabula rasa. You can make it whatever you need it to be. But you know, in fairness, this team's previous film, a kind of poor man's Quatermass experiment called First Man into Space, supposedly took place in Albuquerque, and Bill Warren in Keep Watching the Skies talks about how irisible vision of Albuquerque it is, whereas when I was watching the film, I mean, I've never been to Albuquerque, so for all I knew, that was Albuquerque. And then he talks about how convincing its vision of Canada is in Fiend Without a Face. But Canada has long struggled to have, with its film industry, right? Sitting right next to the colossus of the American film industry, and there have been various attempts to try to get it going. The obvious thing that would likely produce something would be to have imposed a quota long ago, as was the case, for instance, in England, that how they preserved their film industry against Hollywood during the 30s, I think this was. In the 50s, there was a thing called the Canadian Cooperation Project, which sounds very grand. But what this was that gave the United States unfettered access to our market. There was no quota, and Hollywood was able to treat Canada as part of the domestic market, essentially. In exchange, movies were to refer to Canada as often as possible in order to increase our tourist trade. Which is why in this period you have a lot of these films with characters who are randomly from Moose Jaw, or there's just Canada's mentioned in a bit of dialogue for no apparent reason. I can't say that Fiend Without a Face was produced under the auspices of this project, especially since essentially it was shot in England. It was a co-production, but it expresses the kind of bizarre appearance of our country in films of that period. So there is nothing remotely believable about Canada generally and Manitoba in particular in this film. Again, if you'd Sean, if you were watching the scenes of the sand dunes from Lawrence of Arabia and were told that was Florida, you might raise an eyebrow. But it is so completely ridiculous that for Manitoban suspension of disbelief in this movie collapses in the opening moments, that it's actually become part of its crazy charm for me.
So that was your dislike. That was my a dislike. Like. Kind of like my like that was a dislike.
Exactly. So we're bookending.
Fair. That's fair.
I'm super confused because this felt like the Canada I remember. I mean, I was there about in late 90s, and...
Where we all had British accents? And stone farmhouses?
Well, no, not all. I mean, I just assumed the professor was an actual Brit, but, you know.
Yeah, the accents were one thing. At one point, I was thinking, was that a Scottish accent? And then later, maybe that was a Norwegian accent or something? And
yeah, that was so confusing.
That was a little confusing. The Air Force base in Canada didn't bother me a lot because I had vague thoughts about the dew line and early warning systems and stuff like that. But surely an American Air Force base would go through some kind of Canadian military liaison when it was interacting with the town, wouldn't it?
You think, especially based on that scale. I mean, and in Manitoba, there has been a military base that for the last, for about 25 years in the latter part of the 20th century, was hosting a foreign army, but it was the Germans, not the Americans. the fact that we have this colossal American Air Force base where the Americans have, I mean, it appears to be a colony of the United States, somewhere in an unrecognizable Manitoba. There is a shot of a town of the town street which could be kind of Canadian, Sean, in British Columbia, not in Manitoba.
I mean, if you say so, I very much suspect you don't know what you're talking about. Well, so you mentioned this effort on the part of the Canadian government to sort of allow Holloway to use Canada to improve tourism. Did it work?
No, I doubt it very much. No, I mean, it was just a transparent. The Hollywood industry has always lobbied long and hard to prevent there being any kind of quota imposed on what's screened in Canada. Right. So I mentioned this before. We must be one of the only countries in the world where for the vast majority of our film going audiences, they would treat films made in Canada as if they were foreign movies. They tend to be art house the things have improved in sometimes a little bit. But even in Canadian films account for something like, depending on the year, 2 or 3% of the Canadian box office. And that's skewed a little bit because we're counting Quebec, which has a vibrant film industry. But I remember about 10-15 years ago, the government was announcing a program to try to boost the presence of Canadian films in Canadian cinemas. And at that point, the percentage of the box office, I think, was like 2%. However, if you subtracted Quebec from that, and you just talked about English language films, English language Canadian films accounted for 0.02% of box office.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It was a ridiculous thing. Subsequently, there would be we start getting the Canadian Film Development Project, which would become Telefilm Canada, there is a kind of flood of Canadian made product once we hit the late 70s, or they hit the 70s and the 80s, where it's the golden age of Canuxploitation, and we get everything from Black Christmas to David Cronenberg. Cronenberg's first movies to Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS, all of which are technically CanCon because films became a 100% tax shelter. And we had all kinds of cheap filmmakers rushing up from the States to make movies here.
So in other words, people should visit Canada. So that's what this comes down to, is you should visit Canada. So, I mean, I've been to Canada. It's very nice. But I think that there are probably a few places you'd recommend them to go, David. So would Winthrop be a place you'd recommend?
Yeah, well, apparently we can get spectacular alpine skiing in Winthrop, which is news to me. And we're really missing a bet here. When Manitoba downhill ski slopes are glorified toboggan runs, look at this. Look at those mountains. That none of us knew we had. That's a serious oversight there that needs to be corrected. And thank goodness that this movie is here to show us the mountains of Manitoba and teach us the science of cybernetics.
There you go.
So, or cybernetics, whatever it is.
Whatever it is, who cares? Yeah. So in other words, go talk to your travel agent, make a trip to Canada as quickly as possible, so you can see the beautiful. Beautiful mountains of Manitoba.
Or maybe watch a Canadian movie.
Maybe the mountains were there in 1958 and they
That's right.
got destroyed in the blast from the atomic
exactly.
plant that blew up.
And
there
that's
we go.
How we got the Hills Have Eyes. So this movie destroyed all the mountains, Hills Have Eyes, with what was left of the hills, and then the Canadian government just flattened the rest of them. Because they were like, we can't have any more of these crazy guys, Marshall Thompson or whatnot, can't be, no more of this. So they just got rid of it.
Right, and so the fact that the Hills Have Eyes apparently takes place in the United States, that was just a cover-up.
That's propaganda. That's Canadian reverse propaganda. That's you guys trying to make us look bad.
Exactly.
Which, to be honest, we didn't need your help. Oh, goodness. Well, okay, so I guess we got to do me. Is that what's happening now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've talked about most of the things that I found infuriating already. I think, David, you brought up one of the things that I got really bugged by, which was the whole, like, the townsfolk are these super simple people who are morons and superstitious and want to basically run around with pitchforks and all this kind of stuff. That stuff bothered me. But the other thing that really bugged me and has just started to really annoy me about any film, I think, ever that has a bad romance is just how terrible the romance in this movie is. So...
No, it's Sean. Not good. No.
I'm no expert on dating, but I think one of the rules about when you're supposed to hit on a woman you're attracted to is that you don't do it the day her brother has died.
Well, the day of the funeral. He died previously, but yes, bad. Just as bad to hit on her the day of the funeral.
I'm sorry, 24 hours in 1958 was enough time, I guess. Yeah, so... That's what Marshall Thompson is like. It's very obvious. Like, there's no way she didn't know. He's totally hitting on you. I mean, it's 1958 style, which I, you know, is an antiquated version we don't use anymore. But it's just so awkward and so uncomfortable to watch him trying to, like, pick up this girl and romance her in the most inappropriate situations, and then she falls for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand it because, like, There's no point in this movie where I was like, Marshall Thompson, like, he's got game. There's no point in this movie when I thought that. Every single point, I was thinking, like, that awkward guy at a convention who, like, doesn't understand how to talk to women and is just, like, really creepy, and then they make panels about him. And that's what this character is. But yet he gets the girl. It's just so infuriating. It's such a dumb romance. It makes no sense. And it just made me not, I just made me not happy. Like, make it a legit romance. Like, take her out to coffee, for Christ's sake. He didn't even do that much. He gets caught in a tomb and locked in a tomb. That's what he does. That's a date to Marshall Thompson. It's ridiculous. So that's my dislike. It's not very long. It's frustrating. Just watching terrible romance occur and have it actually go somewhere.
Well, I'll just add to it then, in the gratuitous shower scene.
Oh, God, yes!
You know, so far, they've had a completely adversarial relationship. He shows up at her house, and the door wasn't quite locked or something. So, you know, he knocks, and then he just pushes his way in. She unsuspectingly comes out of the shower and sees him in her house. She doesn't scream. She says, "Oh, I'll be a few minutes. Just make yourself at home." No! No! No!
He doesn't even know her. What is he doing walking in her house?
It was very disturbing.
Was this like how it was in the 50s? Was it just people just walked into people's houses?
In Winthrop,
Manitoba, of course. I don't know. I feel like my natural reaction, if you walked in, if it was 1958, and I was taking a shower, and you walked in my house without good reason, and then... saw me come out the shower, I don't think you would stay. Pretty sure I would ask you to leave. But like, maybe next time you leave a note and or call me, but you don't come in. No. And then he gets in a fight with some random dude who's like upset because it's one of those farm people, so of course, like, he's got to put the farm person in his place. But the farm person's not wrong and the major's not right. They're both like 50-50, so they get in a punching match for reasons, and then she kicks him out. And somehow that was their first date.
Yeah, isn't he the local law, too?
Yeah, wasn't that Gibbons? Sheriff Gibbons.
Yeah, so why isn't he arrested?
Yeah, he should have been arrested.
You just assaulted a police officer.
Yes, that's true.
Or at least a write-up somewhere. There was a conversation with the military somewhere.
Yeah, Constable Gibbons.
Oh, Constable, that's right, yep.
Is that what they call them up there, David?
Constables? Yeah.
Is that the proper term? We just didn't make that up for this movie?
No, they didn't just make that up for the film.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that at least they got one thing about Canada correct.
Yeah, because one of our most memorable characters of that ilk, it was in The Beachcombers, where we had Constable.
That's actually kind of fun. Yeah, so that's kind of all I got. I mean, any last thoughts, guys?
Speaking of Gibbons, why was he the only one whose brain didn't get eaten? You know, everyone else, when they were alone with the creatures, got their brains sucked out. Constable Gibbons got turned into a gibbering idiot.
I hated that scene.
Did his brain just not taste right, and so they didn't suck that one out?
Yeah, did it get in? I'm trying to remember that. Did he get interrupted?
No, he just wandered back into town, all making weird noises and not talking.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that was the worst. Yeah, with stuff shoved into his lips to make it look like they're swollen.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't recall him being interrupted. I think he just.
Yeah, they lose him and then he comes back, right?
That's pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And that posse, that search party with all their rifles just walking and quartering the woods seemed just a little strange to me.
In the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Who does that?
Well, the people of Winthrop, where we have, they have this unexpected vertical landscape.
It's almost like they actually thought this film was set in northern Alaska. And we're like in that period of time where there's very little sun. And so you just got to deal with it. But that's I'm pretty sure that's not Manitoba.
Oh, it's definitely not. It's definitely not.
It's just very confusing. I also really hated the part where the brain comes through the chimney, the fireplace, and attacks somebody. And then they don't do anything about the fireplace.
Right.
They just leave it there. Like, that's... No, you gotta put stuff in it. Plug it up. No, they don't. They just leave it there. There's a reason why so many people died in this movie. It's because they're stupid.
Well, they're too busy preparing to dynamite a nuclear power plant.
Right. Oh God, this movie. It's ridiculous. Well, I guess it's about time we should grade this thing. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
All right. So, final thoughts and grade, Trish. You are up first. Go.
It was stupid. But it was not outright offensive, except for the romance. Well, even that, yeah, I did like that Barbara got a few moments to be the smart person. And it was ridiculous, but it was over quickly. So I will give it just a C.
Wow, a C?
No, C minus.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with C minus.
Going once? Going twice? Sold, C minus. All right. Fantastic. All right, David, what about you, sir?
Well, I've made my affection for this film pretty clear. And I think it's another nice example of the enormously flourishing, like the explosion of imagination that happened in the 50s in science fiction film. And, that gave us such gloriously weird monsters as these, or the telepathic crabs in Attack of the Crab Monsters, or the upside down cucumber Venusian from It Conquered the Earth, It Conquered the World. The fiends have achieved a certain kind of immortality there. It is completely wacky and ridiculous, but if we look at the way that the content of B pictures migrate, the way Jaws and Star Wars took the B pictures and turned them into the blockbusters of today, so that's kind of in some ways the comparison purposes we have now. If I were given the choice between watch Fiend Without a Face or say Iron Man 3 again, it would be Fiend Without a Face every single time. I take no end of joy from this ridiculous yet very imaginative and rather gushy little movie. So I'm going to give it a B+.
Oh my God. what the jaw. I need to be drinking for this podcast. Is what that jaw. David. David. You got to at least drop it. Like, you can't. Oh my God.
I was hesitating between a B and a B+. I bumped it up to a B+ to compensate for Trisha's C-.
Well, now I'm going to have to triple compensate. I'm going to have to give it the lowest grade possible now. You've left me no choice. No, I won't do that because I actually have principles. All right, well, okay, so my final thoughts. Yeah, this movie's dumb. There are a lot of things that are just really annoying about it. There are some things that are a lot of fun, as we've mentioned. I really did actually like the brains, the animation. I mean, it's old, So it sort of kind of doesn't hold up because you can kind of tell that they're using stop motion stuff. But it was actually really neat to see that and to see them try to give them life and make them more than just like a thing on a string or, you know, just like some cheap puppetry. So if that was really nice to see some of that there. I like some of the characters, I like other characters a little less. So overall, it wasn't a good movie, but it is not the worst thing we've ever watched. I would rather watch this than read Model Land by Tyra Banks again. So that should give you a bearing on how much I didn't hate this movie, but it was not good. So for that reason, I'm going to give it a C-, because it's not a D movie, but it's not higher than a C-. Just not. Sorry. So there you go. So that's it. So we did it. We did it. We made it through.
And we didn't run over the movie time either.
No, we still got a good solid 8 or 9 minutes to go, so we'll just talk for 8 or 9 minutes about whatever we want. No, just kidding. No, we'll close this out pretty quick here. So if you have any opinions, if you want to watch this, it's on YouTube. It's also got a Criterion Edition, which is what David watched. He paid $75,000 for that DVD. Or was it on VHS, David?
No, it's the Criterion DVD. Yeah.
Got it. Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
For a long time, it was only available in a hard-to-find VHS, so a lot of us were delighted when Criterion announced this release.
A lot of us, huh?
It's basically David and, like, three other Canadians, basically.
I think you'll find Fred Kish has got a lot of fondness for this film, too.
Yes, he does. He does quite like this movie. So if you want to watch it, it's easy enough to do. Just go to YouTube, just type in Fiend Without a Face. Easy enough to find. There are like 3 or 4 different versions there. If you'd like to let us know what you thought about the movie, you can go to skiffyandfandy.com, look for this episode. We'll be on the right-hand side, or you can go to the episodes. Depending on when you're listening to this, it may actually be on the front page. So you can go there. You can also send us an email at skiffyandfandy@gmail.com or tweet us at skiffyandfandy. So you can let us know what you think about the movie or comments about what we had to say. Also, we have a Patreon page, which you should support. It's patreon.com/skiffyandfandy. If you like what we do, if you think we're funny and you have a dollar to spare, consider becoming a Patreon supporter at a dollar level or $1 million. We'll take $1 million too, you know, whatever you've got, basically. And I think that kind of gets to everything that we got going. Anybody else have things they want to make sure people know about?
I think that sounds like you got it.
You don't have 9 books coming out next month, David?
Not 9. I guess the latest one is the mass release of Lamarty's Guardian of the Lost, and Warlord Fury of the God Machine is still marching along across the shelves.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, alrighty then. Well, thanks, guys, for doing this with us. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And on that note, awkward ending and scene. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfandy@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfandy, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfandy. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.